How are you all doing? I hope you have all been well.
So I want to talk to you about the gospel. But I don't want just to talk about the aspect of being saved in the gospel, which is an aspect that is important. I want to talk to you about how Jesus actually communicated the gospel and how we as a church have to communicate the gospel. So we're going to cover the same ground, and it's going to be, hopefully, entertaining in a sense, but also instructive to you. First of all, what is the gospel? Now, the word gospel, of course, is an Anglo-Saxon word, and it simply means good news. But the very fact that it's an Anglo-Saxon word means it's not a Hebrew word. It's not an Arabic word, and it's definitely not a Greek word. And when the King James Bible was first translated, a common expression would have been, if you met someone, is, how's the gospel for you? Be any good gospel to tell me. Because it was a word that was used within the language. So it was naturally that this word for good news should be presented in that. Unfortunately, like many things that are presented within religious institutions, it's stuck. And therefore, hopefully, if I can remember myself, that's going to be the last reference to the word gospel that I'm going to make today, because I want to tell you about good news. I want to tell you about the good news that God felt was so essential that he sent his own son as the architect and planner of this good news to come to this earth and share it with us for a complete 3.5 years. I want to explain how that happened and why that happened. And I want to show you that even when God had arranged to do this from the very foundation of the world, he couldn't do it until he first of all had prepared man to be able to accept this message. And that took about 1500 years today, approximately. So we're not exactly the brightest sparks when it comes to understanding things concerning God. We have difficulties. We have problems. And most of it is because God doesn't speak English. I know, it's a real drawback. And for those who think, well, he must speak Hebrew, Aramaic, Greek, those are human languages. God speaks in spirit language. He speaks to our heart. He speaks to our understanding. He does not speak to our intellect. Our language speaks to our intellect. And this is where we have the problem with communication. You see, if we take communication as it is today, and you go to a foreign country, and you are having a conversation with an individual who does not speak English, and sadly, you don't speak their language, you've had a problem. You both might be very intelligent people. You both may have very interesting stories to tell, but just can't share them. Why? No common ground. You have to find a way around this. So when Jesus came to this earth, he needed to have a way of speaking to us that would allow us to understand the spiritual intent of what the message he was bringing was. So he used analogies, he used parables, he used stories, he used descriptions from everyday life. Now some of these things didn't quite work, because the Bible tells us the people heard the word in their own language, but they didn't understand a word of it. They saw it, the actions happening around them, and they couldn't perceive what was happening. You see, this was because even though he had brought it down to their level and was explaining it in simplistic speech, the spiritual element still was missed. They could not grasp the fullness of the message, because that's one of the drawbacks we have, is that we're not truly spiritual creatures. We're physical creatures. And that is because of what happened in the Garden of Eden. Adam was made in the image of God. He was made perfectly. He was perfect. And as we were covering there in one of our hymns, all authority was given to him. He had authority over everything. He had authority over the animals. He had authority over the garden. He had authority over the birds, the fish, the weather, the lot. Everything he had authority over. But that authority was lost to him. Why? Because he was tricked and deceived and died because of the result of that. And that authority was passed to an enemy. But here was an interesting aspect. The enemy had the authority, but he didn't have access to how that authority works. And that's something we have to understand. The Bible tells us very straight, very simply, and very directly, Satan might be a king over this earth, but he cannot make you do anything. He has to try and trick you into it. He has to try and control you into it. He has to try and get you to do it. He can't. He doesn't have the power. He doesn't have the energy. He doesn't have the means. So, when we look at the gospel message, and there it goes, I dropped gospel again. When we look at the good news, got to get this right, you see. When we look at the good news that God's given to us, he's telling us, look, that authority is yours. It was always yours. I created you in my likeness, in my image, and I give you that authority. It's not Satan's. It's yours. And so you should use it. And this was part of the good news that was being sent. But people had difficulty with this. They couldn't fully grasp this. Now God, when he wanted to speak to people, he had a drawback. You see, because Adam had spiritually died, that meant there wasn't an active element within man that could communicate with God. So God had to use a different method. So he would use a prophet. Now the prophet had a simple job. The prophet told the people what God said. But prophets are, by definition, a blunt instrument. The nearest reckoning that we could really put to a prophet is really a baseball bat, a 2x4 piece of wood that hits you over the head with. That's it. That's what a prophet is. When God is bringing you a message through a prophet, he's telling you as it is, get the message, react to it, because it's very blunt, it's very direct, and it's because you need to hear it. That's when he uses a prophet. But when God, when the people needed to speak to God, they couldn't come to him. So the office of priest was done. Now a priest is not a prophet. There are confusions here. Two offices are totally different. The prophet speaks on behalf of God. The priest speaks on behalf of the people to God. So the priest's office is literally one whereby he is presenting an acceptable offering to God. And God established this in the wilderness using as his perfect prime examples Moses and Aaron. And for, as I said, approximately 1,500 years, we had this arrangement, teaching people that to God, to they speak to them, they had to have a prophet, and for them to speak to God, they needed the office of a priest. And it was as simple as that. And this was all to prepare for the good news. Because when the good news came approximately 2,000 years ago, a prophet was born that was different. This prophet spoke with the full authority of God. He was alive to God. Full life in him. Now, it's very important that we understand this aspect of life in him, because certain tests were given to prove that he was who he was. And I will go into those in a little bit, but in a moment, because I don't want to get to jump ahead of myself, or I'll get lost myself. See, as a prophet, Jesus teaches us about God. And to teach us about God, he had to use symbolism. Now, as a priest, he only had one job to do, and that was to offer a perfect sacrifice to his Father. Which we know from Scripture that when he had done that, he sat down at the Father's right hand. It was accepted forever. We don't need a priest anymore. We've got one. End of story. We no longer need priests. We no longer have a need for them. But we still have needs for prophets. We need to get this gospel message out. And we have to look at how Jesus started to teach this message when he was teaching it. You remember I shared with you at the beginning that when God originally started to call prophets, he used them like a blunt instrument, but like a baseball bat, as I said. And that's exactly, if you, as you look through it, you discover basically they were very direct individuals. And they could be very cross, and you didn't cross them. There's one story which I always remember because I think it's very poignant for the type of society in which we live, where Elisha, the prophet, was coming into a small village or town, and he had the misfortune of being bald. We know this because the young lads of the town decided to call him Baldy. Not a good thing to do to a prophet of God at the best of times. So he spoke to them directly in spirit. Yes, in prayer. He spoke in spirit. And God reacted immediately. And bears came out of the forest and tore them apart. And it's recorded because they showed disrespect to a prophet of God. You can't get much more blunter an instrument than that. No mess. Straight to the point. You do not mess with God's anointed. But when Jesus is sent, we have a completely different prophetic style. Because he's coming as the architect, as the creator of the plan of salvation. And he needs to be able to teach the people the fullness of the plan, not just give them highlighted instances of what they need to do. He needs to explain this to them. And he realizes very fast into the ministry that there's a problem going to occur. And it's highlighted in John 3, verse 11 to 12. And I'm just going to go to there for 12. The story is about Nicodemus. Now, Nicodemus was a leader in Israel. He was a priest, a man who was instructed and knew the law and knew the way of God. But he also was aware that Jesus was a man from God. In fact, he strongly suspected that this was the promised Messiah. He was reasonably sure, but he wanted to be sure. He wanted to be perfectly sure. And so he decided he would go and visit them at night. And he did. He went and he visited them at night. And they had a lovely wee chat and they discussed things. And within the discussion, Jesus pointed out to him that, you know, when a man is coming into the kingdom of God and he's been made acceptable, he has to literally be born again. And Nicodemus went, "What? You what? What do you mean born again? I mean, how is that possible? How could it be possible for me? Look at the size of my neck. How could I get back into my mommy's womb to be reborn? It's not exactly possible. What are you on about?" And Jesus said, No. You're not quite grasping this. You see, Jesus answered in verse 5 here, "Most assuredly I say unto you, unless you're born of water and spirit, you cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. For that which is born of flesh is flesh, and that which is born of spirit is spirit." So you really shouldn't be marvel that you must be born again. But you see, this had revealed to Jesus that there was a problem. Nicodemus, a man who should, I mean, he had 1,500 years of teaching to go back over. He had instruction. God had laid down a lot of ground. And yet, here it was. Jesus is starting to open up new spiritual insights to instruct them as into the things God wants to show them, and hit the first hurdle. They couldn't separate spiritual things from physical reality. They could not do it. And so Jesus literally says to him, "How are you a teacher of Israel that you don't know these things? How do you not know these things?" Now, the way he says this, you can tell that Jesus literally is very surprised at this. Because he doesn't say, "Oh well, you're not expected to know this." No, he didn't say that. He said, "Why do you not know this? Why don't you understand this? Look at the information that's been put before you. Look at all the stuff that's been done beforehand. And yet you, a leader, you the one that's supposed to be out teaching the people, and you don't grasp this?" You see, that was the problem. Jesus said to him, "How am I supposed to tell you the things of heaven if you don't even grasp the things of earth? If I explain to them in an earthly sense and you don't get it, how will you just understand the spiritual language that's being spoken within these words?" And this was the problem. This was it. This was the difficulty that exists when we, in any age, try to promote and teach the good news that came from God. Because we need a point of reference. Now, from this point on, you'll notice that Jesus, when he starts teaching, begins teaching with authority. And it's recorded. Here is one who teaches with authority. He teaches with authority, not like the scribes and the priests who teach from the scriptures and say, this is what it says, so this is what you do. Jesus didn't do that. He didn't say, this is what it says, this is what you do. He said, this is what it means. And he told them what it meant. And this was the difference between the prophetic teaching of Christ and the prophetic teaching that had went before. Jesus was teaching them what it truly meant and how it applied in their day-to-day lives. He was cutting through this barrier, this communication barrier, and trying to give them as clear and as precise a message as was possible for them to receive. And this was the thing that we have to do today. We have to be prepared to do that today. Now, what sort of things did Jesus use? Well, we've got to first of all think, well, where was he? He was 2,000 years ago. He was sitting in what is today called Israel, Palestine, part of that. And it was really a farming industry with fishing. Fishermen from the Sea of Galilee, there would have been tent makers. It would have been a domestic scene, similar to nearly every other town or country in the area. Very similar, in fact. There would have been forests, not a lot. There's more of them by Lebanon, yeah. But there was vineyards, there was gardens, there was grain farming, all of those things that he could relate to. And as we go through this, the message of the good news that Jesus is sharing, he's likening things. He's saying, here's an example, right? He says, here's an example. When you go and you get something from God, now, what he was about to tell them was how generous God is. But let's understand what would have happened prior to that. A bit that's not obvious in the scriptures. But we know simply because we understand how people are. Busy marketplace. People were going in and out of the place and they were buying their provisions. And what you would do is you'd go along and say, I need grain. I want a potful. Right, and the pot was the particular measure that they were using and all the rest. So the guy would come along and says, no bother, missus, here you go. And he would pour in his grain and he would give it a good shake. Pour it in. He'd give it up to her, right? But his shaking up was not to settle it down, it was to build it up. Make it a wee bit fatter, make it a wee bit more. And he would give it to her nice and level, a full thing of grain. He would set it very carefully down the counter and say, there you go, that's the one, so and away she'd go. She would go, she'd put it on the shelf, and after a couple of days, all the air has started to get out of it, and it starts coming out. It's coming down. And she made up with 3/4 of a pot of grain. But she hasn't even taken anything out of it yet. Now, this was a common complaint. It was standard practice with the businessmen. And all the housewives were complaining about it, because they could see that it was very unfair. So Jesus uses the analogy, and he wants to teach them about God and the way God gives things. So he says, look, when God would give you a pot of grain, he fills it up just like everybody else would. But then he goes and he presses it down really hard so all the air's out. And when he gets down to that quarter full, he fills it up again. And he presses it down again until it absolutely, it's level, you couldn't get another grain in. And then he takes another scoop and he throws it on top so that it's literally overflowing when you lift it. That's how God gives to us. He gives us with such a bounty that it overflows. Because that overflow, he's given us enough from our pot, yes? But that overflow, as we're carrying that home, is falling out for the birds, the little animals, or for even the very, very poor who have nothing else to do but to try and find the wee bits we spill. That's how God deals with problems. That's how God deals with us. And that's how his personality is. And of course, we are to reflect that. So you see how Jesus used the analogy to teach a spiritual understanding. He didn't say, oh, just give as you expect to get. He didn't just say that. He'd give them an example of it. He grew on one. He'd give them a picture. He explained the picture and he made sure they understood it. that wasn't the only thing they did. You see, when Jesus was teaching, he was coming up against priests and Pharisees and religious leaders of his day, and they were having problems because they realized this man has got authority. And that terrified them. Because if he's got authority, what's he going to do if he's changing and removing the priesthood? What are we going to do? And so they worked against him. They worked against him for the reason that they were terrified of him. And they tried to say, well, look, the reason he's able to heal these people, you notice that he heals in the Sabbath? Well, the reason that happens and all the rest is because he's using the spirit of Beelzebub. And now Jesus got very angry with him when he said that. And he said, look, now, hang on a minute. If Satan's house is divided, then it'll not stand. And if I'm healing in Beelzebub, Satan's house will be divided. But the very fact that I'm doing these things should be a sign to you that the kingdom of God is coming on you. Now, even Satan knew this. Satan understood this. But the people didn't. The religious leaders of the day didn't realize that Satan can't cure. He doesn't have the ability to heal. He can't. He doesn't have the authority. We do. But we lost it because we died. Remember? We died in Adam. But Christ was the second Adam. He was Adam alive. And Satan knew this. So what was the first, very first temptation that he decided to test out? Do you remember? Yeah, of course you do. He says, you have meat for 40 days. You're very hungry. It's only right. You should thank him. And you have a lot of responsibility. If you are the Christ, if you are the one that's been sent, then simply tell those stones to become bread and eat your fill. And of course, we can take from that as well. And when you've done that, of course, you'll be able to feed all the hungry in the world. Wouldn't you? I mean, wouldn't you? If you could change stones into bread, think of the mouths you could feed. You wouldn't have to worry about anything. Just go over and change. Go to a quarry, get a load, send it over and change it into bread. You could feed them like mad. Suggestions were being put in here all the time. Jesus said, no. Man shall live by every word of God and not bread alone. It's not what you physically think you need. It's what you spiritually do need to decide your true life. There's a big difference here. A big, massive difference in their approach. Interestingly, though, when Jesus performs his first miracle, what's he do? Well, you all know it. He was at a wedding. That's Cana. His mother comes and said, they've run out of wine. They've nothing to drink. The wedding's going to be ruined. You better do something. And he says, well, you know, it's not my time, and I'm not ready to do that just yet. But being a mother, she ignored him. She just went to the servants and she says to them, whatever he tells you to do, just do it. She went back to the top of the wedding where she was going. And the servants naturally come now. They've been given permission to go to this member of the family. It's more than likely Jesus was a member of the family. And, well, what do we do with this wine, sort of thing? We've been sent to you to sort this out, to deal with this problem. Jesus said to them, see the water jugs there for the washing? Go fill them with water. Take scoop and present it to the toastmaster over there. And that's all you have to do. They're saying, we're only paid to do this, we're not meant to think about this life. But that's how they went and they've done it. Now, it's silly really. I mean, we're going to get a right rollicking here when we give this boy water. And they go out, I know you're in there, get up to us, give it to him. Give it to him and said, we have been asked to present this to you by that gentleman there in the robes. And he takes the glass. Not bad. Wow. And he's so impressed by the wine, he goes to the groom. He says, you know, I have been doing this a long time, and I have never, ever seen it done like this. The traditional way, No, I'm just telling you, because obviously at some point you're going to get another wedding and you'll be in charge. So the traditional way is you use the good wine, you know, like this, first, so that your guests think how rich you are and how good you are and how brilliant you are and how wonderful it is. And then when they get a little, the worst will wear, you understand, a wee bit like that. Then you slip them the old stuff, the cheap stuff, the stuff that isn't really going to do them much more harm, but they think it's great because they got an arch, right? That's what you do. That's how you do it. You do not, under any circumstances, give them the best stuff last. They can't appreciate it. You can't give them the stuff they can't appreciate at the last. But that's what God does with us all the time. We are the people of the last age, and we're being given the best of the teaching and the instruction from God. Jesus' first miracle wasn't to feed thousands and thousands of people by changing stones into bread. It was to celebrate a wedding. He supplied the refreshments. Think about that. God is a God who doesn't just meet our needs when we need them. He goes over and beyond that to meet all the things. I've used a few descriptions here of how Jesus tried to enlighten the people by explaining the good news to them in a language and in a method that they could understand. Paul, though, when he had the same difficulty, found that when he was taking the gospel, there I go again, see, I've dropped it on again. It's that contagious, this word. When he was trying to tell the Gentiles all about the good news, he had a problem. He would say to them things like, the vine in the vineyard. You know, branch and the vine, and he would go to them and he'd say to them these things, and they would go, so, what's that called to be? And he'd say to them, and then there was Abraham and there was Moses and the law and how these things, and this is relevant to us, how? You see, there was no commonality. They could not understand these things because these were not these people. This wasn't their background. This wasn't their history. Paul had a problem. He needed to be able to teach a message directly from God, the good news, but he needed a different language. And we're not talking Greek. We're not talking Latin. We're talking he needed another way to be able to present the spiritual language of God. So he used two things: warfare and the games. He taught that for a man to be a Christian, he had to be just like a soldier. He had to be armed. He had to be trained on how to use these pieces of equipment. He had to have a shield that could withstand the enemy. He had to have a sword that he could use and yield that cuts both ways. He had to have shoes that were literally peace, the peace of God going out so that the gospel could be proclaimed. And so he crouched all the language, the message of the good news within these analogies. And as you go through Paul's teachings, you begin to see that this is how he did it. Time after time after time, Paul is presenting the message using biblical analogies. I got an email about a week or two, about 3 weeks ago, and an individual had sent me, they'd got the wee course that I sent out, and they come across with a wee problem and said, course is brilliant, enjoying it, getting a lot out of it, but I do have a question. Why are you trying to describe the love of God using military terminology? And I had read back, well, Paul felt that this was necessary because he was dealing with a Gentile world and this was the common theme that they could understand. But the person couldn't say it because, let's face it, the exact same gospel that Jesus Christ was teaching, there's the gospel word again, the exact same good message that Jesus Christ was teaching is exactly the same good news that Paul was teaching. But one used the reference to farming, giving, fishing, grinding, or what is it? Is it grinding that flour and stuff like that? Getting it down into the grains. He used all those analogies. Paul used the games, preparing yourself to run a race or to wrestle or to do. Or he also said, well, there's also war and we have to be prepared like warriors and get ready to go out.
And they don't seem, in the first thing, as if they could be possibly talking about the same thing, do they? But yet they are, because it's not the words that are the message, but the spiritual meaning within the words. The words are simply the vehicle to bring them across. I want to talk to you today, and obviously this will not all be covered because it's a massive subject. It's massive. I want to talk to you today about the fact that we need a new analogy. And I want to introduce to you a new analogy. It's not warfare. Though warfare is referred to in it. And it's none of these other things, though they're referred to in it as well. And if you like titles, the title is spiritual software. You see, we have a perfect analogy today which didn't exist even 20 years ago. And that analogy is our modern understanding of computers. It has become a universal language. It's in every culture, it's in every language, and it's exactly the same thing. Now, it's so wide, and there's so many different things of it, that it's impossible to cover it all. But just to give you an idea, you have got firewalls. What's a firewall? Well, a firewall protects a computer when you go on the internet so that nobody else can come in and influence you or take information off you or even fire certain nasty virus-type things at you. It helps protect you. Spiritually, we have a firewall. It's called the Holy Spirit. It does the exact same job. That's another sermon. You also have, well, you're all aware of, computer viruses. Nasty, horrible little things that attack time and time again and have only one intent: malice destruction. That's it. They just want to cause problems. We have software against that spiritually too. It's called the Holy Bible. It teaches us, guides us, and directs us to recognize and search out and destroy agents that work against us. We also have a problem of a thing called spyware. Now, spyware is different from viruses, so virus software won't get rid of it. And it gets through firewalls because we give it permission to get through firewalls. Because we get spyware when we go and we check the internet. And obviously we have to get permission to do that, but when we're there, the site throws a cookie. Now, it could be a totally harmless cookie, something that says, "Hello, William, welcome back to the site." It could be harmless, just like that. That's how those things happen, by the way. It means there's a piece of software on it that's going to do that for you. But it also could be a piece of software that's tracking what you have looked at in the last 10 days and reporting that back to the agency that you have now went to, which is Shop, so they can then say, well, this person is looking out a camera, they've went to such and such a store and such a site, so we are going to give them information about cameras, and for the next 4, 5, 7 months let's be realistic here, all you get is emails and stuff relating to cameras coming at you. How'd you get it? How'd that happen? Spyware. So do we have spyware in the spiritual sense? Well, actually we do, because Paul reminds us that we are constantly a spectacle to the world and to the angels. We are constantly being watched, observed. Every aspect of what we do is being noted and monitored. Some because we do good things, it's to praise, and others because we are not the brightest sparks around and said literally creating a rod for our own back. It's all recorded, it's all going to be used. That's the point. Spyware helps us to relate to that, and we can use that as an analogy. But again, that's another sermon. I want simply to wrap this sermon up by introducing a subject that I'm going to have to talk about at another time. And that is firmware. What's firmware? Anybody? Nobody know what firmware is? Okay. Let me show you a few things. See these little things here? I'll flip them up in a moment. Got a few of them. Just got to get them out of the packets. And one more. This here is a small toy that Rachel plays with from time to time. It's made with plastic, a little bit of metal, a battery to operate it, and silicon. That's all it is. This is a personal organizer. Nice simple little thing. It's made with plastic, piece of metal, and silicon. This is the New International Holy Bible. Complete, right? It's made with plastic, metal, piece of silicon. These, you all recognize, calculators and clocks. Guess what they're made of? Plastic, metal, silicon. In other words, all of these things are the same. Oh, including my old favorite here, which is trying to tell me, time to nearly wrap up. All of these things are exactly the same. They consist of the same components, and they consist for the same job. In other words, there's no moving parts in them. They are a bit of plastic to design them. They have little bits of metal which join the things all together, and a few bits of brass that's put in through there, but that's metal. But the main central part of it is a piece of silicon, a small piece of silicon, which has received an electrical charge, and it's that charge that's called the firmware, because it tells this that it's a toy and what to do and how to do it. It tells this that this can take names, telephones, notes, etc., and it wasn't. It tells this that it's the Bible and that all the words of the Bible are in it, and that's what it'll be able to be done. And it tells these that they're clocks and calculators. That's all they do. Yet there's no real difference to them except for the firmware. Now, the firmware itself, for all intent and purpose, is invisible. You don't see it. You can't change it. You can't touch it. Why? Because it reflects directly to a component that we within Christianity would understand, in fact the world would understand it the same way, a spirit. It's an element, usually, that you don't see, but it determines the use and purpose of what the things create. Now, here's an interesting thought. Back in Genesis, when God created everything, he spoke, and things became. In computer jargon, that's programming. Do you understand the difference here? When God created a tree, there had to be a spiritual element to that tree. Therefore, the tree could become a physical reality, but only if it first existed spiritually. In other words, there had to be a spiritual reality. God created a fish, same principle. Now, a tree is a funny thing. We were talking about this going up in the car, actually. Within the protocol of a tree, God has basically given permission to evolve into different things. But it can't evolve out of these things. It can only work within its own thing. Now, some of you may be far more in tune with this particular aspect than I might be, but you can correct me later and pick me up on the things. First of all, a tree starts off as a seed. The seed grows into a shoot. The shoot, over time, produces into a tree, is able to bear fruit, produce more seeds, and all the rest. But as time goes by, this tree will die. And if it's never cut down or anything else, it'll be absorbed back into the ground. Now, where you have forests that this has happened to, over a long time, you end up with bogs. If you wait a little longer, the bogs dry up and become coal fields. If you wait a little longer, two processes happen. If a lot of pressure is being put on the coal field, you'll have a diamond mine. But if a different type of pressure is put on the coal field, you'll have an oil well. Now, all of that has been writ into the life of a tree by its programmer. Now, you can take a rock. Also has been brought together the same way. It doesn't matter how much pressure you put on it, a rock will never turn into a diamond. It will never turn into an oil well. Nor will it ever become a bog. It'll always be a rock. In fact, it's very limited. Yet, when Jesus was saying, you know, when he was coming, when a fulfillment of prophecy had just happened. He was on a donkey. He was being led into Jerusalem as the Messiah. The people didn't fully understand the full significance of it, but they recognized that this was prophecy, and the Spirit of God moved among them, and they were praising God to literally high heaven. And the priests said, whoa, this is bad, we've got to shut them up, we've got to stop them. And so they said to Jesus, you can't let the people go on like this. This is not right. They're giving you praise and honor and glory. And Jesus stopped them just where they were, and he said, listen, I tell you something. I'm going to tell you a reality. I'm going to tell you a truth. If these people didn't praise now, those stones on the ground would, because of what's happening today. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't think Jesus was exaggerating. I know he doesn't lie. And he didn't say, I want to give you an example. He didn't say that. He said, simply, these stones will sing. That's what he said. If you don't, these people stop, the stones themselves will sing. Praises to God. How is that possible? Firmware. See, God can change the firmware. Stones have spirit. Same as everything else that God created. That's how he brought them about. But you say, well, that's very well, William, I agree. It's in computer jargon, yes, you could change the firmware of more advanced items, but, you know, I can't really see that happening. Have you any examples? Have I any examples? Where do you want to start? Jesus commands a tree. He cursed it. It died. What was he speaking to? It's firmware. He killed it instantly. Simple as that. You no longer need it. Goodbye. God spoke to a donkey. Through a donkey, actually. And it spoke with human voice. Do you know many donkeys that have long conversations with you? Of course not. Something had to happen. This donkey, for the period of time, was changed. Interesting, we don't know if it ever changed back. I say that simply because when you go through mythology, you find that in a lot of societies they have certain talking donkeys. And this is actually where we get the example of the talking ass out of. Seriously, it is. It comes from that aspect because it's now considered rude, but one time it was considered to be a reality. You could be instructed by a donkey. That's the reality of the thing. At another time, as we had already said, Satan knew that Jesus could talk to the stones and make them bread. This was not something that should have surprised anybody, because he knew that if Jesus was the one that was come, the second Adam, he had the authority. On your sermon, all authority has been given to man. And that's exactly what happens. But we lost it. But Jesus brought us good news. We're getting it back. And it's coming through him.